Leaving the South Australian Museum that afternoon, I thought of the throwaway remark that Bill McKinnon made late in his life when he told a reporter that Yochanan's remains were down in a basement in the Adelaide Museum. It seemed an apt metaphor for the entire corpus of Aboriginal history in Australia, buried deep in the recesses of national memory. But it also evoked McKinnon's experience in the centre, a region where darkness stalked the landscape, engulfing the interiors of hotels and private residences and shutting out the blinding light that reigned outside. Bill McKinnon had cornered Yochanan in the darkness of a cave inside Uluru. For Yochanan, looking out towards the entrance of the cave, there was one slowly widening shaft of light that led to the place where McKinnon waited with his pistol poised. There was no chance of escape. Thinking of Yochanan's skull filed away in the museum's collection of human remains and the documents that I'd uncovered in McKinnon's basement in a Brisbane garage, it seemed to me that the events at Uluru in 1934 were still shrouded in the darkness in which they began. I'd tried many times to reach the world McKinnon inhabited in Central Australia in the 1930s. Although it was less than a century ago, much of it seemed lost to view, another time and historical context, one that was both recognisable and foreign. I found it difficult to comprehend the pervasive culture of violence, the punching, whipping, kicking, bashing and rifle fire that was such a common part of McKinnon's policing on his early patrols. The sound of his and his trackers raised voices as they extracted confessions from their charges, their private conversation and silences, and the racial borders between them that they knew instinctively never to cross. This was a world in which white station owners never travelled unarmed and always slept with a revolver close to hand. A world in which every white male was a de facto policeman and where anger and frustration could easily spill over into violence, as it did at Uluru, when, after days of chasing his quarry across the desert, McKinnon fired into a cave to hit a defenceless man. McKinnon wasn't a stranger to bullet wounds himself. In 1925, as a young policeman in New South Wales, he nearly lost his life when a rifle he was cleaning accidentally discharged. The 22 short calibre bullet entered his head and shattered into 13 pieces, one of which lodged in the matter surrounding his brain and damaged his left optic nerve, leaving his vision permanently impaired. After 3 weeks treatment in Sydney Hospital, hot baths and one dose of castor oil, he was left with fragments embedded in his skull for the rest of his life. Other aspects of his life and traces of his personality were more familiar to me. In McKinnon, I saw some of the men I'd grown up with in the western suburbs of Sydney in the 1960s and 70s. The tough exterior, the dry, biting humour, the unyielding, granitic discipline, the fierce loyalty to his mates and his white Australian tribe. He was relentless in carrying out what he saw as his duty, even when it led him into brutality and worse. Yet to heap responsibility for what happened at Uluru in 1934 onto his shoulders alone is, I think, to fail to understand the moral and political complexities of that time and place in which he lived. McKinnon enforced a legal system that was brutally and swiftly imposed on the lands and peoples of Central Australia, just as it had been imposed on every square kilometre of the Australian continent since colonisation began, without the consent of its Indigenous owners. In seeking to uphold what he saw as the law, he served a system which asserted the power and right of the invaders to take land at will, a system that brought thousands of cattle, erected fences and borders, pushed Aboriginal people off their country, created reserves that suited white fellas, exploited Aboriginal labour and created new myths of possession. Bruised, laconic tales of bittersweet conquest, which cast the country as the hard-won property of a handful of white men. Bill McKinnon was one such man. As he insisted when he retired from the Northern Territory Police, there are many loyal and sensible people in the Territory who still believe in people obeying the laws of the land, and also feel that laws are made by Parliament to be enforced by Parliament. Yet, of course, it was precisely the laws of the land, prescribed by legislation and put into effect by government officials, police, courts, judges and prisons, that subverted Indigenous law and culture. Bill McKinnon was the dogged pincer in the front line of an entire structure that sanctioned invasion and dispossession. The injustice of what happened at Uluru in 1934 was one graphic example of a much larger injustice perpetrated against the Aboriginal people of Australia that continues to this day. The Anangu at Uluru, of course, know this history better than anyone. As I prepared to return there to Uluru, I kept thinking about Sammy Wilson's ongoing shock regarding his people's dispossession, a shock that non-Indigenous Australians have yet to comprehend. Although they inhabit the same continent, they belong to a different historical experience. Bill McKinnon, in later life, was nominated for an Order of Australia in 1995. He was described as a living national treasure. What contrast this stands to the Anangu's memory of the same man, the policeman who mercilessly killed Yokonana and who later separated children from their mothers. Two histories divided by a vast chasm. At Uluru, I would arrive, when I returned, with the heavy news that Yokonana's skull was in the South Australian Museum. Because his killing was a seminal moment for the Anangu, and the place where it occurred was now seen as the spiritual heart of the continent, the repatriation of Yokonana's remains was at once of family, community, territory, and national significance. I was acutely aware that the Anangu's telling of this history differed substantially from the history I've written here. When Sammy Wilson told the story of the shooting, he would not mention McKinnon's name or the precise location, nor, of course, have the Anangu chosen to make any mention of the events until quite recently in the interpretive panels that grace Uluru today. But what now? Would Sammy welcome the disclosure of all the details surrounding the shooting near Mutajulu Waterhole? In telling that story, he was naturally bound by Anangu law. Would he ask that I too respect that law and refrain from revealing that the dreaming battle that took place there had occurred in the very same place that Bill McKinnon shot Yokonana? And what of the other side of the story? How would Bill McKinnon's family react when I returned to Brisbane and I explained the full import of what I was writing about? Would they try to bar publication of some of the details I'd found in the garage in Brisbane? Would they seek to protect his reputation? Although much was already on the public record, would they understand the national significance of this story? Would they want the full story told? Intuitively, or perhaps it was wishful thinking, I felt they'd be supportive. As I left the family garage on my second visit to Brisbane, McKinnon's grandson, Ian, turned towards me and said firmly, "We need more Aboriginal history, don't we?"